Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Tuesday afternoon. I finished school. And I'm going to take another look. Something caught my attention in the new Gnosim catalog. Again, the Gnosim Auction House is having their Grand Winter event, as they call it. In other words, the auctions on March 3 and March 5 coming up. That's a Sunday, March 3, and the Tuesday, March 5. So that's coming around the corner. And I did the other day about the Zohar in Mantua. And while I was flipping through it on the way back, I saw that there was this letter from Chaim Brisker. Ordinarily, like, you know, big deal. Unless you're a Brisker, you know, really a fanatic, and you were talking about between 25 and 50 grand. So, but then I looked at it a little bit, and I don't know exactly for sure, and I don't have the letter in front of me, because all you have is a photo of the letter with a Chaim Brisker imposed on it, superimposed on it. This is lot number 98. If you're interested, you go online or whatever. It's Gnazim. Again, it's Genazym. Not Z-I-M, but Z-Y-M. And they have something called a poignant letter from Chaim Brisker, Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, Bris 1909. The year caught my attention. And then I see it's being described over here. Hamaruch al Shmiras Yadus Atzruf B'derech Yisrael Tzabo. The fight for pure Judaism. All right, big deal. That's just a shtick. V'chashivas maimet harabonim v'ashpasim al tzuvah shmeres kach Yisrael. And the significance of the portion of the rabbonim in Jewish community and their hashpah on kach Yisrael. And it's 1909. I know what that is. But let me put it this way. I think I know what that is. I'm taking a guess. It's an educated guess. And he says, b'michtav, in this letter, so in other words, you're buying an original autograph letter from Chaim Brisker. Zoik midam libo neged ho irgunim achavshim, against the Fry organizations. I shall call machshu same museum lahashchis lebaris hakodesh, whose intention is to wipe out Yiddishkeit. Now, why did this catch my attention and start me thinking? I'm pulling out some old books, and the answer is, 1909 is a very interesting year. 1909 and 1910. In the history of Russian Jewry. First of all, what is Russian Jewry? Eastern Europe used to be Kingdom of Poland, as I've said a thousand times. And that was true until the 1770s. So it's Polish Jewry, right? Even in places like Belarus and Ukraine, it was part of Poland. The Jews spoke Polish Yiddish of various dialects. Even Litvish Yiddish is a certain dialect of Polish Yiddish. And I hate to tell you. So, because Lithuania was part of the Kingdom of Poland, okay? Matter of fact, the technical name was the Noble Republic, I think, of Poland, Lithuania. Now, then Russia took it over, most of it. I mean, over 90%. So then, the Polish provinces became annexed to the Russian Empire. But they weren't Russian. On the other hand, by the time the wars of the late 1700s, early 1800s were over, Russia was given Poland, and the old, you know, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Central Poland, what they call Congress Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, a gigantic area. It was now under the Tsars of Russia. What the Tsars of Russia wanted to do was Russianize it. So they tried. For 100 years, they were in control. And now Putin is trying to reestablish that control. So let's say, for example, from 1815 to 1915, literally, the Russian ruled, you know, Ukraine and Belarus and all that business, and Congress Poland, that's Warsaw and Lublin and so forth, and they tried to make it Russian, because the Russian Empire under the Tsars was gigantic and had lots of different nationalities and religions, and the Russian way of approaching it was to try as much as they can through above board and below board, sneaky and not sneaky, to make everybody become Russian. You see, the Russians, as far as I can tell, never had like a Nazi-type attitude of this racism. Instead, they hold everybody who converted to Russian. And especially the Jews, who really stood out. So, for 100 years, 1815, 1915, the Jews in the Russian Empire, meaning the old Kingdom of Poland, were tried to be made into Russian Jews. So I know we all use the term nowadays, these are Russian Jews, all the rest of it. From a very strictly historical point of view, it's not so pushy, because when the Russian Empire took over Poland, they did not, they're very anti-Semitic, and they did not allow the Jews to move into Russia. In other words, you can only, if you're Jewish, you can only live in the territories that belong to the old Kingdom of Poland. That's why you have ancestors that came from Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, and so forth. Because you couldn't move into Russia proper, unless you were Richie Rich or some exceptional situation. But 99% more, 99.9%, they couldn't go to Russia. Now, can't go to Moscow, can't go to St. Petersburg, you know, places like that. Okay. Now, the Tsars of Russia either made a full court press or pressure of some kind or other to Russianize the Jews. Their ultimate goal, and I can understand it, was that they should drop being Jews, completely assimilate and identify as Russians, and convert to the Russian religion, the Greek, the Russian Orthodox Church. Then you mamas don't have to worry about them. There were some extreme right-wingers that, you know, were racist, and they didn't even want that, but that was what the Tsars wanted. And one of the things that the Tsars did over the course of the 1800s was to abolish the Jewish system of government. In the old Kingdom of Poland, I think many of you will remember, the Jews even had a Vada Barotzos, which is like a national parliament of a certain sort. And in every local Jewish community had a Kehil. It was elected, however it was elected. It was as honest in its elections as American elections are, you know. And what do you call it? Or Baltimore elections, let me put it that way. And it was what it was. But every Jewish community had the people in charge. A Kehil, the rabbi was appointed by the Kehil, the Beis Dins, the Vada, what you and I would call today the Vada Kashrus, the Chevra Kedisha, and all that business. But the Russian government, for its own reasons, didn't like the Jewish autonomy. And over the course of time, they abolished it, especially that Mamzer and a half. That Mamzer in two halves, Nicholas I, who was the Tsar of Russia for 30 years from 1825 to 1855. And he wanted really to, you know, pull apart the whole Yiddishkeit. He's the one who did the Cantonists. He's the one who encouraged the treasonous Maskilim. He did whatever he could to destroy the old Yiddishkeit, thinking that in its place would come loyal Russianism. Now, he was stupid. All the Tsars were stupid. And instead, you got a little of that, but you also got a lot of revolutionary activity. In other words, if I'm not from anymore, I'm bringing my Russian. If I'm Russian, to hell with the system. It's all against me. It's the Tsarist autocracy, dictatorship. I want to blow up the Tsar and you know, bring a revolution to Russia, which eventually they did. But that's how the Tsar saw it. In other words, they let their heart rule their mind. They let their prejudice against the Jews and their wishful thinking, you know, replace reality. So 2 years, I remember he became Tsar in 1825. In 1827, he abolished the Kehillos. What do I mean when I say abolished the Kehillos? Used to be, under the old Poland, it was Mamish autonomy. The Gaiish state recognized the authority the Jewish community Kehil had over its members. So you got to listen to the Kehil or else you're punished. What I always call the autonomous coercive communities that have been around forever. Before Poland and Germany and before Germany and here and there, you know, all the way back to Eretz Yisrael. So the Tsar, who was a dictator, of course, he abolished that in 1827. From now on, the Jewish community has no legal power over its members. Maybe they have social power or something like that. That depends, but no legal power. If I want to smoke a cigarette in the middle of the street, a Jewish neighbor in Shabbos, nobody's allowed to touch me. If they do, I can call the cops. As time went on in the 1840s, he abolished other elements of the Kehillah, even that was standing there. meaning without its course of power, and specifically wanted to replace the rabbinate. He figured the rabban, he wasn't wrong, are the ones who are trying to keep people from an old-fashioned and non-Russian, and we want to replace them with modern educated rabbis who'll be loyal to the Russian state. You see, the history of Russia is one which the state gained control of religion back in the time of Peter the Great in the early 1700s, okay, late 1600s. Peter the Great destroyed those members of the church, literally, who opposed him, and he turned the church into a department of the state, the Russian Orthodox Church. So he wouldn't do that to the Jews. These are the famous stories you hear that they tried to set up a rabbinical seminary in Vilna, another one in Zhytomyr, one in Lithuania, one in Ukraine, produce what you and I would call non-firm rabbis. Never worked, for a whole bunch of reasons. Nevertheless, the government insisted that only graduates from these schools or the equivalent could be recognized as official rabbis. Regular rabbanim, who had no secular education, could not get any official recognition as the rabbanim. And this created the dual rabbinate situation, which was lousy all around. The community was compelled by the government to pay the salaries of the official rabbi. The official rabbi was usually a blockhead, amaretz, a pharmacist, somebody went to school for a few years, you know, had a high school education, not from, you know, a lawyer's assistant, whatever. And, you know, it's a job. What did the job of official rabbi mean? I mean, people aren't going to Yerushalayim. A lot of these guys couldn't even read Hebrew. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. There are famous stories about that. Some could, you know. For the most part, they were traitors. But they were officially the rabbis of the community. And in Russia, that meant that they're in charge of keeping the metrical books, which means the metrics, which means that they record officially the marriages and divorces, births and deaths, and things like that. So you're not married in the eyes of the law until you're registered by this guy. So you could have chuppah kedushin, you could have a single chana specter be mesadik kedushin. You ain't married in the eyes of the state until you go to this guy, you know, who's like, you know, in the restaurant or something, and he's the official rabbi, recognized by the government, and he's got to, you know, register your name in the book, and you got to pay him off. Same thing for divorces. So, you had this dual situation where the oilam, I mean, those who are not from didn't care altogether, and those who were from went to the regular rabbanim. I think they call them the duchavn rabban, the spiritual rabbis, as opposed to the kazan rabbanim, who were the government rabbis. I know I've spoken about this before. I don't expect you to remember everything I ever said, but this is very famous. So this was a lousy situation, and for a whole bunch of reasons. One of the reasons was it brought a chaos into Chuppah Kedushin and Gittin, because, you know, they might get divorced, and the rabbi, for whatever reason, won't recognize it. Or you might get married, and rabbi, for whatever reason, won't recognize it. So the state says you're not married. And she runs off, marries another guy. You know, the state says she can do it. The rabbanim say you can't do it. She stole Eishes Ish. You know, it was a nightmare for Evan Hoezer. And that's the way it went. Early on, people saw it's a problem. Plus, I'm not saying that the Frum system was perfect, because it certainly wasn't, nor is it now. Even today in America, for example, in the Frum world, we have our share of, you know, aguna problems, I'm sorry to say, controversial divorce issues. You know, what I mean by that is recalcitrant husbands, you know, chalitza, you know, extortions. I mean, it depends on what kind of people we are. Bad people are going to do bad things even within the Dalam Shalocha. So, you know, we have such cases as we know. You hear once in a while a guy gets after Mei Rabban. You know, it's a craziness exists. So the Russian government, which forever, down till today, is always like to micromanage. That's who they are. Like to control everything. When the communists were in power, they literally controlled everything. There was no such thing as a club. You had to get approved by the party. That's how it went, by the Communist Party. So under the czars, they tried as much as they could, even though they didn't have enough of bureaucracy and they didn't have the modern means of administration. They're always undergoverned, as the historians say. But they tried, you know, to control everything. And here's the interesting part. Did the Tsar of Russia have anything to do with Rabbanim? No. Because he considered himself all a bunch of Eskimos, you know, a bunch of nuts. Plus, he know they want to hold on to their positions. Rabbis, they want to hold on to the old Judaism. He wants to get rid of it. So if the government ever had to do with any Jewish question, they bring in a businessman or somebody, like that. No, an assimilate type guy who would try to aid the government in its efforts to modernize and Russianize and assimilate the Hamonon. Once in a while, when they really needed the people to go along and they really, really, really knew that nobody's listening to these non-frum, you know, bankers and businessmen and stuff that people listen to, once in a while, they would, you know, try to get a couple of real rabbis and put the screws on them. Everybody's heard of the famous case, I think it was 1843, when they, under Nicholas I, when they brought in that guy, Bezalel Stern, who was the principal of a non-frum school, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'm talking about the Tzemach Tzedek, and Itzel Petterberger. I'm sorry, Itzel Voloshin, or the son of Chaim Voloshin, Rashi Voloshin. Because they wanted them to go along and say, you know, give their approval of something. Of course they gave their approval, but, you know, it didn't mean anything because everybody knew it was done by Inus. They didn't mean it. The Lubavitcher said the Tzemach Tzedek resisted. It's a different version of what happened. Anyway, so now, in 1848, this is still under Nicholas I, the Mamzer and a half. So the state bureaucrats, because remember, Russia had no Congress, no elected officials whatsoever. So the government was run top down. So that means the Tsar rules everything and do whatever he wants. But you want to run it in an organized way to the degree possible. And so he ran a bureaucratic state. He had the bureaucracy under them, the officials. And these are people you had to, you know, deal with. So, if you're an official and a bureaucrat, you try to deal with problems bureaucratically. I mean this in a good way. You set up commissions, investigation commissions, to draft laws, hear different opinions. But at the end of the day, you can impose what you want on the people below you. You try to be intelligent, not to do things that people will resist, but you can do whatever you want. For example, when they said Jews got to change their clothes, the Jews resisted. The Tsar felt like, the heck with this, we're going to make it happen. And he did. That's why the Chofetz Chaim doesn't have a Hasidic shtreimel. I'm very serious now. But instead had that Russian hat, you know, with the visor and everything like that. Because they had to go along with certain things the Tsar insisted on. That's a whole separate parasha by itself. Now, dealing over here. The Tsar of Russia, in 1848, set up what he called the Rivinsky Commission, the Rabbinic Commission. This was a consultative body. So the Minister of the Interior runs everything. He's in charge of internal affairs, including the Jewish religion. They even had, within the Ministry of Internal Affairs, a Department of Religious Affairs. Their idea is to control the different religions in the Russian Empire from the point of view of the government. Okay? And they used to hear complaints here and there about rabbis or gittin or marriages. And I'll say it again. Bad stuff does happen sometimes. I mean, in Bnei Brak, in Lakewood, in New Square. I mean, things like this can happen. We're not saying only a fool said the firm world is perfect. We have our problems. So who do you deal with? Who do you go to? You go to the rabbinical commission, right? Which is set up by the government to supervise the rabbis, examine controversial gittin questions. People complained that they were, or women or whatever, complained they were screwed over by the rabbinical system, and they wanted an appeals body to talk to, which is not necessarily a bad idea, except what's it doing under the Tsar of Russia? So make a long story short, they set up this rabbinical commission. There's some books on it now. And they met a few times. One was in 1852, one was in 1857, I think in 1861, 1879, 1893, and then our period with which this letter in the Gnosum is about, 1909, 1910. And from the beginning, like, let's put it this way, this rabbinical commission was just supposed to deal with problems in the rabbinate and all the rest of it, had no rabbis. Okay, the first guys were, you know, business people who obviously had pull with the government, and the government appointed them thinking that, you know, they'll, what shall I say, you know, they'll deal with these problems in the spirit that the Russian government would want. The second time, in 1857, also, there were no, there was one, I shouldn't say that, Rabbi Yaakov Arit, who was a very chashuv Talmid Chacham. He's really the Rebbe of the Chafetz Chaim, actually. Was a rich guy in Vilna, highly respected. But again, you know, it was overwhelmingly non-frum commission. So this commission, which is supposed to report on and deal with the problems in Jewish life from the point of view of Jew religious stuff, was composed of non-frum people. Okay, they, notice they don't know Jewish law. They don't know even Russian law. But they're rich, or they're well-connected. Same thing with the third session, which was 1860s, was a period of extreme Haskalah and assimilation. The fourth one was 1879, again, with no Rabbanim. So you see what I'm saying? The whole thing is like sabotage from the beginning. Has to do with the natural biases, prejudice of the Russian officials. That's what it is. Now, the Tsar has changed. By the time you get to 1890s, it's Alexander III, who was an extreme right-winger, and all the ideas of the Maskilim in the past, which is if we become a little more modernish, we'll get better treatment from the Russian government, were exploded as not true. By the time you get to 1890s, so you see several very interesting things. And I don't want to devote a whole podcast just to this, so I'll just make one or two points. One is that they're disillusioned with the Hamona, with the Maskilic program, even with the liberal program. They didn't think much was going to change in Russia. And they were right, not under the Tsars. On the other hand, the Frum, by this time, had started to organize themselves to lobby more effectively in an organized way within the government to get what they wanted. This is a very interesting phenomenon called the rise of Orthodox Judaism within the Tsarist Empire. Orthodox Judaism is used by historians not simply as Shomer Shabbos, but as people with a self-conscious political attitude that we're the Orthodox and you're not. We're different than other Jews in this way. We have our own agenda. Has that modern political twist to it. And long ago I talked about this with the musical Hans Spector, and especially with his secretary, Yaakov Levi Lipschitz. In their way, and it was very hard to do this in the Russian Empire, the Tsarist state, they tried to organize the Frum so that when time comes that the government every once in a while calls one of these commissions, the Jewish communities should lobby and they should recommend to the government from people, especially Rabban. This started in the 1870s. They weren't successful in the first round. But by the time you get to 1890s, and this is where Yitzchak Chanan Spector was already coming to Rav, it was very well known, and so forth and so on. So for the first time in this commission, you had four unfrum Jews, but you had four real Rabbanim on there. Okay? I mean, you have Shmuel Mulliver, who is a biggie. You have Tzvi Rabinovich, who's the son of Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan. And I forget who the other rabbi was. But, you know, some Lubavitcher. I'm serious. I'm very serious. I'm not being funny. You know, a chashuv guy. I forget what his name was. Milkovsky, something like that. So you actually had Rabbanim on the rabbinical commission for the first time. And I mean, real rabbis, not a reform rabbi, something like that. In the past, they once and twice had a reform rabbi, which was a joke. And this reflected the fact that the Orthodox now are starting to get their act together. Again, it was the old school. It was the Golchanas circle of Yaakov Levi Lifshitz, Alexander Moshe Lapidus. Those names. And Lubavitch was its own. I'm very serious about it. Notice, nobody had to tell them how to organize. They had their own system. And they were well, plugged in certain circles of Russian government. And I'll say it again. By this time, all the promises of the Haskalah seemed to be stale. People could even see already at that time, Hamonam, even if you are not particularly from, you can see it leads to assimilation, it leads to intermarriage, it leads to a weakening of Jewish identity, conversion. It was clear, right? So those even people who were not from themselves couldn't say we're the model. They could criticize bad stuff among the from, and there is room for that, but they couldn't say that they're the ideal model. Especially if you're dealing with questions of rabbinical authority and things of that nature, Gittin Kedushin, Yerusha, Chalitza, all kind of things. What's the right word? All kind of Aguna type cases. So, and has the Russian law deal with this? So, let me put it this way. By the time you get to the late 1800s, early 1900s, some in the Russian government started to see maybe the Orthodox rabbis is a better group to connect with. This was highly controversial. And you had a Russian Revolution in 1905, which almost worked. That freaked out the Tsarist system and the bureaucrats, even though the system survived, but the leaders of the Russian government were the prime minister and so forth were aware that they're sitting on a volcano. They just were not able to do anything about it. That's the whole parsha by itself. And when they came now for a new and the last, the sixth session of the rabbinical commission, that's 1909-1910. You see where I'm going with this Chaim Brisker thing? 1909-1910. By that time, the Frum had organized themselves in a political way. In my opinion, a lot of it has to do with the rise of Zionism. When the Zionists started in 1897 to make a Zionist Congress, and they did one every year, and it looked very chashuv, and the Zionists claimed that they represent Klal Yisrael, this shook up the Haredim, and they said, well, we got to do something along these lines. Eventually, this turned into Agudas Yisrael, which was not successful, but I'm saying Agudas Yisrael, and certainly not before the First World War. But within Russia itself, the Russian Empire, you had the equivalent of that. Perhaps you will recall in 1909, that very year, that's when Chaim Brisker went to Germany, was Chaim Eiser and others, to talk to the Yekis about what eventually became the Agudas Yisrael. Who was in charge of that? The historian, the Doris Rishonim. You can look all that up yourself if you want. So, when the time came to government to choose who would be in the rabbinical commission, they did include a fair number of real rabbis, including Chaim Brisker. So that means somehow the Russian government, who never even knew he existed, they kicked him out of Volozhin when they knocked down the yeshiva. That's all they knew. And he's a rabbi of Brisk. Well, what does that mean to them? Brest-Litovsk. But, they actually have the Russian records, in which he has, I have it here somewhere. They send out to the secret police, questionnaires. Who are these guys that we're now getting as, names recommended, to be on this commission? Who's this guy and who's that guy? And they were looking for Lashon Hara. That's what you do when you have a state like that. And I remember they said, well, investigate this Chaim. Here it is. The governor of Grodno informed central authorities the 61-year-old Chaim Yosef Soloveitchik has not participated in any political movements and has conducted himself in a proper and moral manner as a spiritual rabbi. Spiritual rabbi means not a government rabbi, because Chaim Brisker was certainly no government rabbi. He couldn't speak Russian. Okay? And let's put it this way. They really put together an A-list to go to the commission. Not businessmen and clerks Maskilic writers and stuff like that. He had Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Meiser, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, a couple of Lubavitchers in there. I was the Rabbi Chaim, that's the Lubavitch. Cyrilson, who I spoke about before, Yulib Cyrilson. I mean, these are real guys, right? No, they had among the leading rabbinic personalities, excuse me, in there. I remember they had two Schneersons because Lubavitch was a civil war. So they had one from Bobrovsk and one from Lubavitch and all. Let's put it this way. They actually made it a real thing. And this commission was set up by the Prime Minister Stolypin, who's a very interesting person. Peter Stolypin, who was assassinated in 1911, is now heavily studied because he tried to save the system by doing what we would call today conservative right-wing type reforms. And he knew, I mean, it's a very complicated question, I'm just simplifying it. He knew that what's going on with the Jews is not good. It's driving them to revolution. Anyway, it's not a normal system. They have to live in a pale settlement, and they're subject to all these legal restrictions. Moreover, Stolypin, who was a real guy, real. And his secretary, by the way, was a Meshubit, who was anti-Semitic. That's a separate Zach. Stolypin had been the governor general in Kovna. And so he knew where Yitzchak Hanus Spector was at that time. And I don't know what they had to do with each other, but he knew his reputation was being very honest and beloved by the masses and, you know, socially very conservative. Yitzchak Hanus Spector had a high, what's the right word? A high reputation among the Russian bureaucrats with whom he dealt. And one of them ended up being the prime minister of Russia. So anyway, so in 1909, they said they're going to have the elections for the committees, the rabbinical committees. And one of the things they're definitely going to try to deal with is this business of having a dual rabbinate, the government rabbi and the real rabbi. The real rabbanim hated, naturally, the government rabbis, and they wanted to abolish them altogether. That's not what the non-from wanted. And furthermore, the non-from wanted certain reforms to be pushed in by government fiat. And there were intensive election campaigns to be on this rabbinical commission recognized by the government as having, you know, consultative powers, I would say. But that's as close as you get to a real election under Tsarist Russia. And, you know, the elections were hot and heavy. And I'm convinced that this letter in the Gnosim is exactly speaking at that time. Because Reb Chaim Brisker is a candidate. And he was elected. And the people running against him are a bunch of hilarious. That's a fact. As he puts over here, you know, Kolmach Shavosem Mazimosem Hurakal Hashchis Ulabal Sakodesh. I mean, the non-from included candidates that said, you know, give divorce over to the state. No, let's just have a civil divorce. Let's have a civil marriage, among other things. Let the Jewish communities be run totally on a government basis. Or, you know, let the non-from have a total control over the kilos, things like that, which was a destructive program. Okay. Now, a lot of these non-from wanted, literally to replace the from system, whatever was left over in the communities, with government Russian state law. And they would have done it if the First World War hadn't come around a couple years later, in my opinion. And the communists, of course, did it without any thought whatsoever. One of the questions was, and this is the part I'm going to speak now you've heard of. One of the questions was, maybe you get rid of the official rabbis, you replace them with the real rabbis, but the real rabbis have to be able to speak Russian, have some minimum secular education. As you know, a couple of rabbis were in favor of this. Including, what was his name? Dor Samech. We've all heard one time or another this argument that broke out almost a fist fight between the Chofetz Chaim and Dor Samech over this issue at the rabbinical convention because the Chofetz Chaim apparently was there. Not as an official member. You know that story and somebody said you have to separate the two Kohanim. Kohanim are Kaisanim. It's a famous story. Cyrilson was there also. I remember Cyrilson was in. It's funny, the Lubavitchers were split. Cyrilson What's her name? Professor Fries has a whole book on this. Cyrilson was in favor that they should. He knew Russian. Well, the Lubavitch actually, as you know, lived mamish in Russia. Now, I mean, they lived in Belarus, but I'm saying they lived in an environment in which you picked up Russian. I mean, I remember the Lubavitch Rebbe spoke Russian. You remember that? I'm sure the Freer Dicker Rebbe did also, and probably all of them did. But I remember. Well, hold on for a second. Let me find this here. One second. Here you go. This is a report of the one of the sessions of the rabbinical assembly. Now, the actual commission met in 1910. Right now, Chafal of Adar, for a month. And it's one of the issues was, this is talking an interesting thing. Okay? Let me see over here. It was hardly, I'll read you two paragraphs, because it's very interesting. It was hardly surprising that the question of the dual rabbinate, which is what I've been talking about, given its complexity and significance, should have so engaged the participants. Particularly contentious was the issue of whether or not the state should legalize the status and role of spiritual rabbanim. That's what Rav Chaim went, that's what Chavos Chaim went, that's what they all wanted. That the real rabbanim should be recognized as the real rabbanim and given that power by the state. The most ardent advocates argued that the spiritual rabbis should not only be given official status, but should be recognized as superior to those educated in secular schools. Right? So that's really like a Brisker attitude. That the, if you have a secular education, that's a negative. You see? They're referring to the state rabbis who had higher education but had no knowledge of matters of the Jewish faith. The opponents categorically rejected the proposal. Legalizing spiritual rabbis would mean giving people who are uneducated and fanatical, they said, unlimited power over the Jewish population. The spiritual rabbis and the capitalist Jews purposely try to keep the Jewish masses in ignorance and superstition, they argued, and will demoralize the already established state rabbis. So you hear the two sides, okay? A related issue was the educational requirements for the position of state rabbi, meaning the official rabbis. Although a majority concurred that they must be learned in Jewish law, they disagreed over a specific one. I'll tell you again, you just don't know what the chaos it was. I mean, you could go and say people get married, let's say, for example, Chuppah Kedushim, without going to the state rabbi. Save money. And then the guy would go off and marry somebody else. He would go to the state rabbi. He said, well, I'm not married. The first marriage wasn't recognized and it wasn't entered into the metric books by you. So this is my first marriage. Well, I'm basically turning my first wife into Naguna because I'm married to someone else now and she can't go anybody. And she had Chuppah Kedushin, she can't go anywhere. And the state rabbi, being like I say, a blockhead, he'll say, well, you're not married because you're not on the, not in the official books. Yeah, just one example of many. People think everything was peachy keen back before the First World War in old Eastern Europe. It wasn't at all. And all this is due to the stupid Russian state. You didn't have this under Poland, but you did have it under Russia. So again, some contended that the nominee should pass a special test by an examining committee to determine their competence in halacha. Others argued that an individual's degree from a rabbinic seminary or a theological institution should suffice as evidence of training in Jewish law. You know what that's about, right? And the enlightened Jews on the commission said only you have to have a high school degree or college degree. Once the discussion turned to the language requirement for rabbis, meaning, should it be that someone who's recognized by the Russian state can speak Russian, any semblance of civility and comedy dissolved as the participants became embroiled in a fierce fight. The Maskilim faction and the Hasidic rabbis viewed the knowledge of Russian language as an essential prerequisite for anyone seeking to serve as a state rabbi. Isn't that funny? You think the Hasidim are different. When he says Hasidim, he means Lubavitch. Well, I have to not use the word Lubavitch because that time Lubavitch, it was Lubavitch, but Chabad. Okay? You think Chabad would be opposed to, knowledge. They all spoke Russian. They lived in Russia. It's not like they lived in a Polish area. The language there was Russian. The Tzaddik Schneerson of Bobrovsk, that's obviously, the Bobrovskers, delivered an emotional speech claiming that ignorance of Russian had brought much misery on the Jewish population. If the Jews, the rabbis, knew the state language, would they not be able to intercede on behalf of the people to the authorities? Okay? This Tzaddik of Bobrovsk reminded listeners that knowledge of Russian did not go against the calling of rabbi. But on the other hand, the Tzaddik Schneerson of Lubavitch, however, vehemently rejected such arguments. No qualification is needed for the spiritual rabbis, he shouted passionately. Secular knowledge of any sort, in his view, was dangerous for the spiritual rabbinate and could only alienate them from the Torah and draw them closer to the intelligentsia. Okay? So in other words, within Chabad there was a civil war. Okay? And I'm not going to more and more. Now, Reb Chaim Brisker and all that was totally against any Russian. I mean, if you know what you know, but I mean, that you should, be required of a rabbi. He said, the whole thing stinks. Now, this letter, if it's 1909, and he's complaining about those who want to understand, I'm reading the Hebrew part from the Genozim Journal. Binyan HaRochal Shmir Seyadis HaTrufa B'derech Yisrael Saba V'chashivus Maimed HaRabonim V'ashposim HaTzum Al Shmir Eskot Yisrael. When he says Ma'amin Rabbanim, he means the real rabbis as opposed to the government rabbis. And it was not a joke. You see, it was a major problem. And they were all afraid this commission may end up recommending or arranging that the real Rabbanim get fired or something like that, and the government Rabbanim get put in as like controllers of Judaism, which would be a churban and a half. Okay? And he says, the Anoshim Irgunim Chachavshim He's not wrong. Now, I'll say it again. He didn't say, and nobody could say, that everything was, fine and dandy within the from world. But any solution then has to come from the from world. You get what I'm saying? Not from Stolypin, and not from rabbinical commission, not from everybody. Well, I have to be careful about that. You see, the tendency was that in future, now they did not know that a few years later the whole Tsar's government would, cease to exist and you'd be under communism, which would make the Tsar's government look great by comparison. They thought, nobody knew that, this happened in 1909, 1910, and all of a sudden 1914 was already World War I. That was a game changer. They thought in a couple of years would be another rabbinical commission, all the rest of it. If we can get in all from, if we organize ourselves properly, and we get in all from, and again, you have people like Chaim Meiser on there, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and Chaim Brisker, and I remember the Tel Zerub was supposed to be one of them, also, he died that year. Real people, maybe it can bring out some kind of improvement in the situation of the spiritual life of the Jews in the Russian Empire, which was the largest community in the world. Now, it didn't happen. And they say, I've read before here and there in the Chaim Brisker biographies here, I remember where that he said the whole thing is baloney and the state's a liar and all this kind of stuff. Maybe he said it, maybe then, I don't know. But he was certainly, by the time you get to the first decade of the 20th century, Chaim Brisker was very political. Maybe it wasn't early in his life when he was teaching at Volozhin and starting out in Brisk. But by the time you get to the particular, unusual political situation, what we call the fin de siècle, which is the last 20 years before the First World War, especially the reign of Nicholas II, was a blockhead and a half. So, boy, was he a dummy. When these kind of situations happen, it was a possibility for Jews to get organized and maybe possibly win recognition from the government. Now, it never happened. And to tell you the truth, I'm not saying Reb Chaim was wrong. Truth of the matter is he was right. And I'm not saying this is a frummy thing. If you know the history of Stolypin, the prime minister, he worked out at great detail certain plans with all the bureaucratic details to have a slight improvement, just a slight improvement, in the Jewish situation in the Russian Empire, simply because he said it'd be good for Russia and would stop all the bad publicity and things like that. And he submitted it to the Tsar, Nicholas II, who likes Stolypin. You know, he's the one who appoints him. And the Tsar said, like, I don't care if you're right or wrong. I have Ruach HaKodesh that I'm not supposed to change anything like I'll be the Jews. They should stay screwed. He said, really? I had the Ruach, I have like a feeling, you know, that comes to me. Yeah, hold on for a second. Yeah, here it is. I found it. Stolypin submitted this proposal for a slight improvement in the Jewish situation because Russia had pogroms and the whole world was condemning Russia and the Jews are legally discriminated against and all this kind of stuff. Maybe it should change. And it says Tsar Nikolai indicated that he had thought about the Jewish question night and day, as he said, before he received this recommendation, and he concluded that he could not agree to any relaxation of the restrictions. And this is what Nicholas II wrote. An inner voice keeps insisting more and more that I do not take this decision upon myself. Let's help the Jews. So far, my conscience has not deceived me. Therefore, I intend, in this case, also to follow its dictates. I know that you two believe that the heart of the Tsar is in God's hands, like as Lev Tsar and Beit Hashem. And this is like my Ruach HaKodesh that I should not do anything good for the Jews. So be it. For all those whom I have placed in my authority, I bear an awesome responsibility before God and ready any time to account to him. In other words, he said like this, I follow my intuition. My intuition tells me I shouldn't do anything to help the Jews. So that coincides with what Rav Chaim Brisket said, that the Russian government will never change. Not in his time. Now, it could be true that God hardened his heart to bring him down. You know, if I wanted to put a firm spin on it, the Tsar could have fixed his situation a whole bunch of times and made things a little more liberal and easy, and then you wouldn't have a Russian revolution. But, like, Hashem, ani akshes lev paro. That's what you mamish see in this memorandum. So this letter, which I think was lot number, what was it, 88? I forget the number. I had it in front of me. But you can look it up. Or 99, something like that. Here it is. In the Gnosim catalog. It's lot number 98, right? On page Kuch Chav Dalet. And let me put it this way. You're really getting a sense of how the Gedolim of the caliber of Chaim viewed the contemporary situation in Russian Jewish history. So if you're a player and you can put down 25 to 50K, then more power to you. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that part. And again, the Gnosim auction of this item is coming up on Sunday, March 3. What's today? February 20. So, yeah, 2 weeks, I guess. Sunday, March 3 and Tuesday, March 5. And with that, I bid you a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.